Welcome to the Iowa Innovation Podcast, powered by Nuboco.
This is the show where we talk to leaders in innovation, education, and entrepreneurship. Hey, what's up again? I'm Anthony Betters.
Hey, and I'm Jessica Abdoni, and I kind of lost my voice at a Taylor Swift concert.
T-Swift.
But today's guest is Brian Glick, co-founder and artistic director of Revival Theater Company. And today we're going to talk about working with different people from professionals to local artists, sticking with your niche when it comes to all kinds of business models, as well as theater, and educating the business community on why supporting the arts is so important.
Yes, and stay tuned because I might throw out a reference called DFO that you might not know about. So if you want to know, listen up. So with that, let's innovate, Iowa.
All right, so Brian, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what Revival Theater Company does?
So Revival Theater Company was started almost 10 years ago, 2014, and it was a brainchild of Cameron Sullenberger and myself. We had met doing a show at Theater Cedar Rapids. He was the musical director, and I was actually in the show. And we bonded, and we worked on a couple independent projects after that. Sideshow and Baby. There's like these shows that we did to raise funds for nonprofits. It was sort of our way of getting shows on their feet when we had no money. So we said, hey, you know, we'll give you X percentage of the profits if you pay for the rights for us to do the show. So anyway, and then I moved to New York for a while, and then we sort of stayed bonded, and I ended up coming back to do a show with Orchestra Iowa. And through those conversations while I was out of town, we didn't realize it at the time, but we were developing a company. So basically what we were developing was a company that focused on musical theater, was the full repertoire. And more specifically, shows that we didn't think were being done, or we thought we could do a little better. so we that kind of narrowed down to classical works and more contemporary, what we refer to as rare gems, and putting our stamp on it. And a lot of times these shows are really good pieces, but are not successful commercially in like New York or Chicago or, you know, Washington, but would do well here. So that was the primary focus of it. You know, prior, like I said, prior to the company starting, I had been working as trying to build my resume as a director. I originally wanted to be an actor and did a lot of performing as a child. TV, not TV, but like commercials and stage stuff. And then did some modeling. And then when I was going off looking at schools for college, I realized I don't think I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember like touring a school in New York and standing on some street corner in New York and turning to my mom and going, "Yeah, I don't think I want to do this." So I thought that was a good time to tell her then before she started paying all this money into a school.
Yeah.
So and I started focusing my ambitions and energy on the more administrative side of things and the directing. And I think I probably got that bug. I grew up in the church, and I started doing passion plays there. And
What's that?
It's like, you know, like Easter shows, like, you know, Jesus, you know, coming out of the tomb and those things.
Yeah.
Which is sounds crazy, but like it was, I grew up in a small town. We were chatting about that before we started here, like of 700 people. But I had this really cool church that sort of let me do what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I remember it started with a confirmation class. You had to like do a project and they give you a list. And one was like doing like a 10-minute play and or a reading or something. And mine was the play and I was like obsessed with it. I just couldn't like do a reading. Like I had to get like, you know, like those heat lamps you see like in a chicken coop. Like I had to clip those up for like stage lighting, you know, because I had to go all out. Anyways, and I think I got the bug then of like, trying to bring something to life.
I would have loved to have seen that, like, your stamp on Jesus's, like, resurrection.
Right, exactly.
It's fabulous.
Well, here's what's funny is I found this book of, like, this Easter pageant. I don't know if you remember, like, the Crystal Cathedral, which no longer exists. in California. And they used to do these really big, elaborate productions of Passion Plays. Anyway, I was inspired by that, and I wanted to do that in my church. So long story short, my sophomore year of high school to my senior year, this show went on 3 consecutive years every Easter. And by the time we were like, I was the final year, we had like 50 people in the show, and we had a full set and everything. It turned into this really big thing, and I just got the bug from there.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of how it started, and then, you know, the rest is history, I guess. So that's you know, a little bit about me. You know, I still love performing. I don't get to do it, but I do miss it. But I will say, I think directors who perform or choreographers who performed, they have a different perspective on mm-hmm. how to work with actors and what they're going through. And I think that's helpful.
Is that sure. how you came out with your name Revival? Is like you're reviving these pieces that many people don't get to see?
Ooh.
Or was it a completely different story for the name?
You know, it's funny. I think, yeah, it is. It's like, what do we do? It was like breaking down. What do? We revive shows. We bring shows back. It was like, and even if that isn't what we do, we were sort of narrowing it down to like, where does the name come from that?
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, we revive, we bring shows back to life.
Yeah.
I think that's just sort of how it started.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then I remember for a while, it was like, is it Revivals Theater Company? Like it was like little things like that. And we had 3 names. I think Cameron had one like Then and Now Theater Company, you know, something like, and we were with friends of ours and we did the game where it's like, we say it and you have to say yes or no to it immediately. You
can't
think about it. Like what your instincts tell you, and that's how we determine the name.
Okay.
So, that's awesome.
That's kind of how. Yeah.
Cool. And then even with, of course, like I'm not super in depth with the theater and all that good stuff, but is it hard finding actors? I always thought that might be like an issue sometimes, like finding actors to help out with that.
Does that set you apart from company and like volunteer-led productions, right?
Yeah, so it's interesting because we started in 2014, and prior to that, the community was very different. The theater community has changed a lot in the last 10 years, almost 10 years. There's been a lot of growth with nonprofit arts organizations. You know, when we started, we were like one of the first companies to start up, and prior to that, it was SBT, and they had started, you know, some years before that. Otherwise, it was pretty much TCR.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember back in the day when you go to a TCR audition, there would be like 100 people. There'd be like a line down to the lobby because they were the only game in town.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also doing great work. And Damon Cole, who was the musical director there, and Richard Parker had a strong following. So it wasn't that hard for them. It's gotten harder now, but it's sort of a double-edged sword because it's gotten harder because there's more stuff for people to do, which is great. But at the same time, it makes it harder to find performers. So it's always been part of the mission and the vision to be a regional company for actors across the Midwest and around the country to come mm-hmm. and do shows. It's a slow build to get there because there's a cost to that,
right?
And a strategic process to that. Because it's not just getting actors here; it's housing, it's transportation, it's, you know, it's all those things that come with it that can be it's a lot. So, you know, we depending on the show, we are very strategic about like what we need. Do we have, you know, do we think that we have these actors here? Like for instance, Color Purple is a great mm-hmm. example. You know, we don't have a robust community of artists, people of color here, mm-hmm. and so we. You know, we had to go outside the realm of our community to hire those actors to come and perform.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty in that is, one, you get to work with great people, you meet new people, and you build these relationships. Because the community is small around the country, you know. And people say, hey, I did this show in Cedar Rapids, you know, you should go work. And we've had that. But there is something really special, I think, about actors who are doing it for a living, who have had all this training and are working in the professional realm and then working with what we consider professional actors of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And because they learn from each other, you know, or they say, you know, or one might say, you know, you could go out and do this, you know, mm-hmm. and so they get sort of that boost to maybe try venturing out of the community. So, it can be difficult. So you kind of, like I said, have to be thoughtful about your show selection and, you know, and how much you can afford to bring in and, yeah. you know, all of those things.
My experience with you, the first time I was ever in a revival project was Ragtime, and I was in the choir, and I loved it, but I thought it was so cool because I still follow your lead guy, Ezekiel,
yeah.
And he was a professional that you brought in for the lead of Ragtime. And he is incredible. Like, he was so sweet to everyone. Like, we, you know, through rehearsals. And then, like, I follow him now on Facebook. And he's doing incredible things in New York. And he's joining other companies and commercials. And it's really cool that you get to, for Cedar Rapids especially, who has a very lively theater community, there's a lot of options, like you were saying. But it's really cool with Revival is because you can go see a show. And you can see, like, yes, very talented local community people who have dedicated their time, but then you also see these professionals. And I think that's incredible because not a lot of, it's a privilege to go to Broadway or Chicago or places like that and spend the money.
And that was pretty cool because Ezekiel had, I think that was his third time playing Cole House and Ragtime, and he played it maybe two or three more times after that. He just got married this weekend, too. But anyways,
congratulations, Ezekiel, if you're listening. Yeah,
but what was cool is we brought him back, right? So the first thing we did after the pandemic was Bruce Orchestra, which is this concert that Orchestra Iowa does every year. They don't do it anymore, but we were the last ones to do it with them. I hope that wasn't why they didn't do it anymore. But we did this big concert, and we brought Ezekiel back to perform in that. And then, like, few weeks after that, he got cast in The Lion King on Broadway.
Wow.
And he plays understudy Mufasa and goes on quite often. What? And so he and is a very good friend. And so that's the neat part about bringing people in, is the relationships you build, the connections. Mm-hmm. You
know? For sure. And even just seeing, of course, people come through, and even like Ezekiel to be able to play in The Lion King and stuff like that. Could you talk about just the innovative ideas for you to even maybe bring people in, such as actors or actresses, or different innovative ways that you've created to make a stamp for Revival?
Well, I think part of it is the talent, mm-hmm. because it's, you know, there's something really special about seeing people you know from the community or who are from the community, but there's also equally something special about not knowing who the people are and being introduced to their talents. I mean, Million Dollar Quartet was a great example. I knew that we didn't have four guys who could play the music from memory and look like those characters, mm-hmm. like Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and so on. You know, so I knew that those people had to be brought in.
Yeah.
You know, they also have to, like, rehearse together all the time, which means they had to be free during the day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that's, like, another unique example of, like, a show where we need to bring people in. But then we bring in Tad Paulson and Amy Stoner, who could, mm-hmm. those roles can be done by local performers who are equally as professional as they are. There's some different tracks in their life, you know, what they're doing. You know, could Amy go out and do it for a living? Of course she could. But, you know, these guys are. So, you know, and they played it, I don't know. Actually, two of the guys in it have been doing it for, like, 6 years playing this role. Mm-hmm. They just go from show to show to show. So it's funny to just sit down for the first time in a room and say go, and they just start doing it. Like, you don't have to really rehearse anything. I mean, you do, but...
Because they're that good.
Yeah, they're that good. So, I think that's... I mean, I don't know if... I appreciate the word innovative. I don't know if it's innovative, though, but it's a unique part of what we do, and that's different from what other people... Because we're not a community theater, mm-hmm. and community theater means something totally different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can expand our talent pool out. And that doesn't even just go for actors. That means designers, you know, choreographers and lighting designers and sound design, you know, all that stuff. So,
and that's something I don't think about.
Yeah.
You know, within theater, I just think about the actors and the actresses. Yeah. But there's a whole production staff that, of course, has to make sure that it goes well from the lighting and the music and all that stuff.
Exactly. And because the other thing is our process is shorter than most. You know, most people rehearse 6, maybe 8 weeks. We rehearse 4, maybe 5 weeks. Yeah. And so it's with one night off a week. And so, you know, the process is intense.
Mm-hmm.
It's it's organized and it's again strategic, but it's very fast and can be overwhelming. So people have to come in and really know their stuff, and mm-hmm. we just go for it. You know, we're not about like, well, let's play and experiment here. No, it's like, this is how we're going to do it. Go, go, go. And if the actors are good enough, which usually they are, they can then take it and make it their own. So that's another angle that is different. And some people like that and some people don't. They like a slower process mm-hmm. that works for them. And that's great because there are people who do that. And that's the beauty in having various arts groups in town who have a different approach to things. But there are people who do because their schedules are really busy.
Yeah.
And so if they're only committing this amount of time, a shorter amount of time, then sometimes we can get really good people who can't always commit to a longer rehearsal process or run.
Well, tell us about your process. Like when you get, like you're doing Sunset Boulevard soon. What dates were those, just to like plug in your next show?
We open September 22nd.
So you know you're doing Sunset Boulevard. What are the process from start to finish? Do you have like a vision in mind? Like, and also when working with these actors that, or if you bring in actors or actresses that have done these shows multiple times, do you ever have to like collaborate with them because they're like, oh, this is not how the other productions mm-hmm. have done it? Mm-hmm. Or like, what is that like?
So a great example of that is Million Dollar Quartet, because those guys have played it multiple times. And so it can go a couple different ways. Mm-hmm. It depends on the person. In Million Dollar Quartet, you had people who were like, this is your production. I know I've done it 1,000 times, but well, tell me what you want me to do.
Yeah.
And that's typically how I approach. But, you know, once in a while you get an actor who's like, well, my character wouldn't normally do that, which means I've not done it that way in the past.
Yeah.
Right. And you sort of strike the balance. You go, okay, well, what if you tried it? Yeah. And then you kind of see where it goes. And then if, you know, they kind of are, you know, being a stink about it, you might go, okay, fine. Just, you know, you pick your battles.
Have you ever demoted anybody?
Demoted?
Or like kicked out somebody because they just wouldn't. Okay.
Oh. Well, I mean, the only time I think I've kicked someone, well.
Ooh.
Okay. Well, it depends. it depends. I did have to remove someone from a production. It wasn't this dramatic, but actually it was a production of Violet, who we had cast as one of the lead roles, and he just was not going to be able to do it.
Sure.
It was over his head, and I saw what was going to happen, and uh-huh. I had to say, this isn't, and that's hard because you're like, no, I can do it. And I'm like, you can't, you know? And so that was hard. But you know, you do what you got to do.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I mean, there's bigger fish to fry and you've got to get the show where it needs to be. So there's that. I mean, I've certainly had a couple of very dramatic things, but you know, a lot of times in the end, the process can be dramatic removing someone, but it's better in the end
mm-hmm.
because
right.
they were kind of causing a hiccup forever, you know,
yeah,
for the
yeah.
process. So in terms of demote, I mean, I've like removed someone out of a number. We did that recently. I like the 2 days before we opened for Honk, I was like, half of you have to go. This isn't working. And it's not you. It just isn't working.
Yeah.
And they were kind of actually okay with it. So, because it was a really quick costume change. So they're like, I don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
Or like someone who just couldn't do the dance in a mm-hmm. number, say, you know, I think you should do this over here.
Yeah.
And the reality is it's so they don't look silly on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard for an actor to realize. You know, I'm not doing it because I'm wanting to make you feel bad.
Yeah.
I'm doing it because you're not going to look your best up there.
Yeah.
Right.
So let's put you in a position where you succeed.
Yeah.
And you know, and most of the time it's on us. It's like, I shouldn't have put you in that position. So let's try something else.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've never had anything too,
dramatic.
Good.
But I was doing a production of Evita, and this is shortly after, Trump was elected, which is interesting to be doing a veto when Trump is elected. If you know the show, the parallels are a little frightening. Anyway, we were doing our first run through, and one of my actors, who no longer lives here, told the stage manager he wasn't going to show up to rehearsal that day because they had like protesters had shut down the interstate,
mm-hmm.
and he was part of the group. And I went up to her and I was like, "Listen, I'm not a fan of his either, but if he's not here in 30 minutes, I'm replacing him."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she just stared at me like this. And I went, yeah, no, go tell him. Go. And then she comes back like few minutes there. And he's like, he'll be here in 30 minutes. You know, I was like, yeah. You know, it's like, so yeah, I certainly
got to put your foot down.
You got to put your foot. Yeah, I mean, you have to. You have to like steer the ship. And you know, it's like, look, when we're in this room, it's about one thing, and that's getting this production on its feet.
Yeah.
So you got to leave all your personal things to the side.
Right.
I've seen you in action on that, because with when we did Sound and Music, you directed. You actually sometimes direct shows like outside of Revival. Mm-hmm. You directed Sound of Music, where I played Nun, and it was a starring role. Yeah. My parents couldn't find me. They're like, they thought I was kept, they thought I was on stage left the entire time.
Wait, they couldn't find you in, they're your, like, in oh, your original costume?
In the well, yeah, it was just my face. Yeah, and they're like, oh yeah, you were beautiful like when you did this. And I was like, that wasn't me.
That was not.
And they're like, we were watching the wrong Nun.
That's funny.
But I just see, I think it's like a true work of a professional, and something that, you know, I think every director aspires, is that you communicate so well with the adults, but then also all those Von Trapp children, because you double cast the Von Trapp kids, which I think was genius, because kids get tired and, you know, they
especially
need a break.
Especially the little Gretels.
Oh, the little Gretels. They're so cute. But yes. But it was just how you kind of changed it. Like, there was one, I won't say it, but there was one of the little boys who obviously was just like goofing off. Like when you see your friends and your family, and then he was like moving around. And then I remember you walking down swiftly and like, I saw you move, and I was like, oh my gosh, this kid's gonna get it. Like him off stage. But you were very like direct. And at the end of the day, we've got a job to do, and it's in front of people who pay tickets and want to see a really well done production. And it was just great to see how you have, from start to finish, how you took Sound of Music and kind of added your flair and something that like people maybe have not seen from Sound of Music. And then, yeah.
Well, I will say, when I first started directing, I did a lot of kids shows. So that, I guess, prepared me for working with Von Trapp.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Sneaky Von
Trapp. And I taught a lot
kids.
Of education classes, which I don't have any desire to do anymore. And it's not that people think, oh, you don't like working with kids. No, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
I just would prefer to work with adults most of the
time.
Yeah.
I think like, everyone would.
it's like if I was ever to be a teacher, I'd want to be a high school teacher, because I can get a product out of that age group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I feel about it. But and so I learned very early on, don't treat children like children. Treat them like adults.
Yeah.
As you should.
Yeah. And so when they do that, then they rise to the occasion, you know. And yes, you get a child every now and then that's all over the place. And you just, you know. It's more powerful sometimes to just be eye-to-eye direct than screaming and yelling. That doesn't really get anywhere. So I learned that early on. I used to be that person. And I remember a friend of mine who's a director came up to me and said, so I hear you're a screamer. Like, you like to yell at people in the rehearsal hall. And I was like, uh-huh. and that ended that. I was learning. And a lot of my learning early on was like in the moment, which has lots of pros and cons, right? But I, learning on the spot was like the best. I was in an environment and a lot of times where I could just learn as I was going. And so that was great.
I've definitely seen you in those moments. It sounds kind of creepy, like I've watched you, but like, you know, when you're like standing at the end and you do this kind of thing, like, I'm sorry, I know this is like not the medium where people can see what I'm doing, but I've got like one hand on my chin, but you just kind of like do this point thing where you're like, no, that's not going to work. Yeah. It's awesome.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you know, kind of going back to your question about like what was the question?
Was
it like
what
we do like specifically?
You like know, from start to like finish.
Oh, start to finish. Yeah. So I mean, you know, we like I was like, hold on, I don't remember. I know. I looked at you and I was like, no, yeah. So you know, because our process is shorter, you have to. Everyone has to come in with like their ducks in a row. Like it's like already packed. Now that doesn't mean. Because a lot of times I get asked, you know, what's your process? You know, it's like, do you come in with the blocking all laid out? Do you not? And yeah, it's laid out, but it always changes. And most of the time when it changes, it's for the better.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to come in with the game plan. Like, I can't, like, bring you into a room and go, okay, what do you want to do? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, no, there has to be a game plan.
Right.
Like, I established the room. You know, it's like, this is what's in the room. This is how you get in. This is how you exit. This is where the window's at. And, you know, this is what's going on in this scene. What are we after? What are our objectives? And go. So you set it, and I let the actor try and fill in. But in my head, I have plan A, plan B, plan C. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To fill in case you guys are like, I don't know what to do. Okay, well, then this is what we're going to do.
Right.
So, you know, and if you work with experienced actors, they know how to take that and run with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So Yeah, we do. Especially with choreographers, they have to come in and have it set. Because if they have to set six numbers in 4 weeks, really 3 weeks, because you don't want to be doing it the week you open.
Yeah.
You have to tackle a lot in a short amount of time with a lot of people. And a lot of times you're not always working with dancers. So some people take a little longer to get, to get.
So what do you mean by that? Is it just some people who think that they can dance?
Or just people who... Well, it's a mixture of both. A true dancer, you would teach the routine and probably would have it immediately.
Right.
Not everyone's that way.
Okay,
I see. You could like use terms that they would understand and then you have to kind of explain it.
Exactly. It comes down to the terminology. They might go, what? You know? Yeah. You know, so they just take a little longer to get there. And, you know, but that's the case everywhere. I mean, we don't work in an environment in Iowa where you're going to find triple threats, you know, across the board.
How dare you? I am one.
So, you know, you have to be, not every actor is the greatest singer dancer. Not every dancer is the greatest singer actor and vice, you know. So you have to find that balance. And at the same time, I'm finding people who are, you know, who are going to be direct in what they want are a little flexible and are good at layering in numbers and placing people where they will succeed the most. So yeah, I'm in 2015, I worked at the Drama League for a summer with Marsha Mulgrim Dodge, who's a Tony-nominated director choreographer, and it was me and
just say that under your breath.
Yeah, just drop that.
Just drop it. Yeah. and she, this is interesting to chat about because she, that program involved me and four other directors, and. What we did was we went there, we were each assigned a choreographer who we had never met, and then we're assigned actors that we've never met. And you get, you know, a short amount of time to and you're given a side. So like mine was Little Shop and someone had Annie and someone had She Loves Me and someone had, I don't know, something else, Merrily We Roll Along. And so you put this piece together. And then she sits there and she watches you work and then she critiques you on the spot. Now, I grew up with very strict teachers. I had voice teacher, choreographer, and acting teachers who were very, very much tough love. I mean, so I learned to build thick skin at a very early age. And so I was somewhat prepared for this, but not quite. And here's the thing, you're given actors who you don't know who you're given, and my actors were, well, they were, it took longer to get them to where I wanted. You know, they weren't like, you know, these, they were across the board talent talent-wise, and I struggled in that workshop. I mean, it's really hard to sit in a room that's like this size, and she's sitting there like eating her yogurt, making notes, and just goes, and she goes, stop, that's not working, you got 5 minutes to fix it. Well, that's like telling a painter, paint something different in 5 minutes. It's like your brain just doesn't work that way. And also you're like nervous, and it's so, you know, I mean, it's like, it's really hard. And everyone's watching, and everyone's taking notes about everyone, and it is really hard, the method is the Juilliard method, which is break you down, make you feel like you're worthless, and build you back up.
Oh, wow.
And because how badly do you want it, and how much are you willing, how hard are you willing to work in this industry? Because it's not easy.
Yeah.
And of course, what makes it even harder for some people, and for me too, is you want to impress her because you want her to be like, oh, come work with me.
Yeah.
I'm going to the Muni in a month to do a show. Why don't you be my assistant? I mean, that's what you want.
Yeah.
Okay. And so also Marsha is just tough as nails. Yeah. She don't mess around. Mm-hmm. She is really tough.
Marsha.
Yeah.
I just went straight to the Brady Bunch.
That's right. That's right.
That's where my mind went.
What's that?
My mind went straight to the Brady Bunch.
She is not that.
Okay.
She's the opposite of that.
Yeah. More of Succession, kind of.
So I remember the final day, we all sat in this round table. And there are people who had like master's degrees in directing and choreography. I mean, all this stuff. And I remember her, like, we had this round group discussion. And it was like people were crying and all this stuff. Because all this stuff happened. Like, one of the choreographers had to drop out, and she, or one of the actors dropped out, and the director had to step in and do the role, and all these things happened.
Yeah.
And I remember her saying, I remember her saying, like, shouting out, shit happens. Mm-hmm. She goes, it happens. That's the point of this, is you have to, is training you on how to work through it and troubleshoot. Yeah. Like, how good are you to suck it up and make it happen?
Yeah.
And she goes, I'm doing a show at Goodspeed. My stage manager had the flu and this general manager had to call the show. He's never stage managed a show in his life. I don't want to look at that rehearsal report tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
You know, but guess what? You do what you got to do. And I remember her saying that. And I also remember her saying, get the show on its feet right away.
Mm-hmm.
Stop bullshitting around.
Yeah.
And like taking forever to teach a scene or whatever. No, people need to visualize what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then fill in the blanks later.
Yeah.
And I remember she had just done Ragtime on Broadway. And one of the actors was working as a director in the room. And he was like, yeah, he's like, we like, you get the show on its feet right away, and there's so many pieces to fill in, mm-hmm. but you have the framework.
Yeah.
And yeah, things get cut, things get changed, and I'll never forget that. And I remember the final, after all of that, and I remember going up to her afterwards, and I was like, well, don't you think that like telling everyone to do all this and this is a little micromanaging? She goes, no, it's not micromanaging mm-hmm. at all. You don't leave actors wondering, and don't set up a room for actors to show you what you should be telling them. You should have done the work already.
I told them.
Wow.
And she goes, do you think Bob Fosse did that? Do you think Michael Bennett did that? Do you think Susan Stroman, all these like major greats in the Broadway world? No, they didn't. So that night, the final night, I went to see On the Town on Broadway. And I was so down because I'm like, I'm a failure. I'm quitting the industry.
The Juilliard method worked.
I'm going to go like work, you know, at some other job, you know, whatever. And I remember sitting, this is so cheesy. I remember sitting on the town and I was like crying. So I'm like, well, I'll never get to do that. and then it wasn't until I had all these notes and I'm like, and by the way, I didn't have any of this realization that I'm telling you now. It was, my brain was so drained.
Yeah.
It wasn't until like 3 or 4 months later, I did a production of Parade.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden everything just like went like that. It just lit up in my head like a light bulb. And now like everything that I learned from that, like just was like in full view in my mind's eye.
Mm-hmm.
And it taught me so much about how to, you know, steer a ship and lead and the homework I need to be doing and all that, you know, changed my viewpoint on a lot of things and how I work in the room.
That's incredible.
Which is crazy that you say that, because Marsha reminds me of, his name is Coach Kaz. And so I played football at Baylor. And of course, like I played football just, I would say I played in high school. And of course, before that, you know, like Pee Wee League and all that stuff. And so whenever you kind of talk about Marsha and kind of how she was kind of tough on you, it reminds me personally back of sports. And Coach Kaz, when he was at Baylor, now he's at TCU and he's doing great things there. I think they actually just won the Big 12 championship last year. But with him, he always told us DFO, and that means don't freak out, right? And so what he was saying is that there's going to be play calls, you know, there's going to be loud noise that you might not be able to hear what's going on, right? Or even if we're in practice and you mess up on a play, don't freak out, right? He's going to yell at you, right? And all the other coaches are going to yell at you, and they're going to basically see, okay, hey, is this the guy that we want on the field when the game is underway and that we actually need a touchdown? Do we want him? Or do we want this other guy who can actually be able to listen, right? And be able actually to take the coaching, and that's another thing, be coachable to be able to be on the field, to be like, okay, hey, yes, I trust this guy to be able to listen. And so when I think of, whenever you talk about Marsha, I think about Coach Kaz and how he instilled that into my life. And that's how I feel as though I kind of lead my life as well, is a lot of stuff around you is going to happen. Yeah. Right. But it's up to you as a person to be like, okay, like shit, like, am I going
to, how good are you to work?
Right. Through? Am I going to freak out, or am I actually going to pick myself up and try to figure out like how I'm going to be able to get through this? And so shout out to Marsha.
Yeah.
Do you have,
she still
a,
scares me,
but do you have a Marsha type?
Do
story?
I have a Marsha? Yeah. Oh, I live with my Marsha. My dad's kind of the similar. So Marsha breaks you down and then builds you back up. No, I think that's incredible, because a lot of people think theater is just like a bunch of jazz hands and just people could like talking about like, oh, theater's so like wishy-washy. I feel like, so, like, you know, people who are on the outside who just think it's just like, you know, a bunch of thespians getting together and like reliving the old days of high school. But it's really, I mean, I was in the Sound of Music. I'm not saying that was like what you went through, but it's just incredible how hard people work, the thought and the methods that go into it to put on. I mean, geez, putting on like massive shows that you have put on is incredible. And there's so much thought and work behind it. So it's really cool to hear you listen about what, you know, your training and who taught you and Marsha yelling at you and, you know, those kind of
things. I grew up with a Marsha, so that I was prepared for her, but still it's a lot. Like so my first thing I ever did, so back in the day, they used to have what was called the Kirkwood Performing Arts Camp. And it was this huge performing arts camp in town. Hundreds of kids went there. It was for 6 weeks. It was very intense. And I remember the first year I did it, we went to sing the opening number and I was in the front row and Carolyn goes, stop, in front of the whole camp. And she goes, she points to me, she goes, you don't know your lyrics. And we were doing Seasons of Love. And I went, and she went, you're done for the day, and sent me home.
Oh.
Mm.
You guys, I mean, like, I had no idea.
How old were you?
I don't know, like 8 or 9.
Oh my
and my
gosh.
mom worked there, so I went. She sent me back to her office. I went back to her office, and she goes, "Why are you back here so early?" And I was like, "You know, my lip was like fluttering," and I was like, "I know." She goes, and my mom was the same way. She's like, "Well, you'll learn. So sit there the rest of the day." And
yeah.
So I just like that's been in me. Not everyone's that way.
Yeah.
And I found that out as the director. Sometimes I'm a little too tough. Some people go, you know, they're not as, they have thick skin as you sometimes. So, but the cool thing about, the other neat thing about that experience, the Drama League, is my musical director for my showcase, him and I have become very good friends. Mm-hmm. And he's actually coming to a musical direct Sunset and works on Wicked on Broadway and does a lot of stuff. And we've stayed in close contact and actually was going to be in our production of End of the Rainbow pre-COVID. Yep. And then he couldn't come back to do it when we put it back on post. But so, yeah, it's, I mean, it's I think that's the part that I try to tell people is it's not just getting on stage and playing the part, you know, hitting your spot on the stage. It's, you have to have thick skin. You have to have a good solid foundation if you want to take it seriously.
Yeah.
And I think that's also the beauty and our community is if you want to do it just for fun, and this isn't a negative towards any organization.
No. But
if you want to just do it for fun, there are places to do that.
Yeah.
And that's great. You want to do it on a more serious level. You want to be treated like a professional and, you know, there are places to do that as well in the community. So I think that's the beauty in our arts community is that there's something for everybody.
There's definitely a lot of different, you know, things for people that are different, like their levels of experience.
Not everybody wants like a process like Revival, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So there are other places that that person would fit in, and that's great.
So would you say Revival is a little tougher than some places, especially if you're a beginner?
I think it's tougher in that our process is so intense. So it automatically, because it's so short and we throw so much at you, you have to rise to the occasion or you'll sink.
And I think sometimes like the level of musicals and shows that you pick are kind of are difficult too.
Yeah, they are either a little more headier or even just there's a lot of material.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like Sunday in the Park with George for like any Sondheim piece, you know, it's not easy material.
Yeah.
You know.
So with Cedar Rapids, which I love is that when you like we've talked about this is that you do get a mixture of people, but I love that surprise when you go see a show and you're like, is that my dentist? Like, you know, you get to see people from Cedar Rapids who are incredible, but they have day jobs too.
Right.
And so like they commit to it. But to put on Revival shows, I know we were talking prior, it's not cost is like as pretty high, you know, to put on levels of shows. So what are your kind of like fundraising? How do you accumulate to be able to afford to put on your next show?
Oh, that's $1 million question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had to ask it.
That's good. You know, I often say this. I say this to my board all the time. You know, musical theater is the most expensive art form next to opera.
Mm.
It is, and it gets increasingly expensive all the time. And I think doing theater right now is very difficult for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Post-pandemic, I think we're really starting to feel it. I think in this community here, we're really starting to feel the economy and the inflation and just the cost of everything.
Yeah,
it's just getting so expensive. So it never feels like it's enough when you're fundraising. But I think one thing that's taught all of us in the industry, one thing that COVID taught us is that everything's on the table and you have to be flexible and willing to try everything. Mm-hmm. I think before COVID, we were like, no, we're going to be stubborn and we don't want to do that. And I don't think you can really do that necessarily as much anymore because mm-hmm. everything's just so different.
Yeah.
And we're still figuring things out. And, you know, with economy and inflation and the costs rising and all those things, that affects the bottom dollar for those who are going to the theater.
Yeah.
And it always was an issue before, but I feel it's really sort of hit hard now. And every day I feel like I see these institutions saying we have to postpone things or close because they just can't make it happen. Yeah. And that can be from a number of things. It can be from poor leadership or low attendance is becoming more frequent lately, and just, again, rising costs. So, you know, we're actually in the middle of figuring that out. We just hired someone to come on board to lead development for us and really try to find more solid ways for us to fundraise. Mm-hmm. You know, that's probably one of our weakest things, which should be one of our things at the forefront. But, you know, raising money is hard, and it's, there are people who do it really well, they're gifted, and then there's no one in between.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like I've taken plenty of fundraising classes, and I remember at one class I took, she says, you know, don't ever use the word need, because no one needs to give you their money.
Right.
You know, so I mean, there's all these tricky little things that some people just are gifted at, their wordsmiths about asking. So, you know, I mean, we do a lot of like the annual giving, you know, reaching out, fundraisers, and, you know, just those are the biggest things that what most people do, because ticket sales certainly don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's challenging for us because we, you know, we perform mostly now at CSPS Hall in the Newbo district.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a smaller house, meaning there's less seats, which makes it a little bit more affordable to produce a show there. But on the flip side, there aren't as many seats.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
you can't take sales.
You lose ticket sales. So it's like, do you do a run for a month to make up for it? You know, it's like we're still trying to figure out that sweet spot.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult. And the trick with all of this, with the economy and fundraising and figuring out, you know, a new venue you're living in, is you can only take so many hits before you start to feel the effects. So you can't be like, oh, we'll figure it out after four shows. We can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where you see theater struggling, is because they're being forced to flip and make changes on a dime.
Yeah.
And really, that stuff in a perfect world would take months to years to figure out. So, fundraising is tricky, and you know, especially going into our 10 years, you know, we're trying a lot of new things, and all of our shows next year will be at CSPS,
mm-hmm.
and we'll have slightly longer runs to hopefully fill that gap and be a bit more solvent in the financial department. But a lot of it is relationships. Is building relationships, because those who can give, whether it's large amounts or smaller amounts, are hit up all the time from nonprofits. So what makes you unique?
Mm-hmm.
And the first step is us having a relationship. Like, you know me, you trust me, you know we do good work, you believe in the mission and vision, and that makes you want to write a check.
I'm right there with you.
And, you know, I think a lot of people, and I get it, because it takes time and energy and the people to do it, just want to send you an email or a brochure and say, give. That doesn't cut it mm-hmm. anymore. I mean, you might get a little gift out of there, but you know, that's not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's finding donors who can, don't give me that amount now, but commit 5 years. Give mm-hmm. me a 5-year gift. You know, it's doing those so that I can anticipate each year that I have this coming in.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and that all takes time.
Yeah.
I mean, we just recently had some great success with a donor who I've been for 3 years, I've been trying to get them to give. They haven't given me anything. And then they dropped us a very sizable donation. But so, you know what I mean? That's hard. That's
right. Hard. Yeah. So at New Book Oso, I'm on the sponsorship side.
Mm-hmm.
And this is new to me in a sense of doing it for a year, that I've never worked at a nonprofit outside of New Book Oso. But especially being a nonprofit and asking, you know, making an ask for money is a little bit different, right? Mm-hmm. And how you articulate your ask, of course, is different to each business and also each person.
Right.
But just kind of what you just said is that having, like, sitting down, having coffee with them and actually trying to create that relationship hits a little bit different, yep. right? And of course, you can have that relationship even if it doesn't work out, just because, like you said, right. 3 years later on the line, it may work yep. out, but they know that you truly love what you do, and that you're just not going to stop at them, right?
Right?
Mm-hmm. And
right.
if they see that you're doing this over and over and over again, they're like, oh, dang, man, like, this dude, like, he really does love what he do. Like, I actually want to support this.
Yeah, you know? And they also, I mean, here's the thing. They look at who else is giving, mm-hmm. who else is supporting. And there's follow the leader. That's
true.
A thing.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. They want to be part of the group. And
fear missing out.
And the other thing I always say, and this is hard, when it's always about the work. It should mm-hmm. always be about the work. And it's really hard for us to not be like, let's do Mamma Mia 1 and 2 and The Sound of Music and The Music Man. Nothing wrong with those shows, but that's not what
Revival... I couldn't imagine you putting on Mamma Mia, I'm sorry.
I love those shows, but that's not what Revival
yeah.
does. But it's easy to want to do that when you know they sell every seat times
right. yeah.
two. It's really hard not to want to, you know, do what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
And so that is tricky. It's very hard to, like, stick to your mission. But... Yeah, and the other thing, too, that's hard is in the corporate world, corporate giving has gone way down. Because corporate giving, they've gone from steam to stem. They've eliminated the A. Or they say they're steam and they're really not doing anything with the A.
Yeah.
But what they're doing is they're focusing those funds on human services, which is important. But what I've been saying is these companies can do both.
Yeah.
They're choosing not to.
Really?
And this could be a whole other podcast, I've had those discussions and arguments with several big businesses, because what I say is, okay, major company playing company in town, let's say you live in another state and you want to come work here. What do they do to get you here? They send you a fancy brochure,
yeah.
and they say, "What is in it for my family? We
yeah.
have a world-class orchestra. We have these schools that do this. We have we have theater
yeah.
and all this stuff.
Nightlife.
Yeah, we have all these things, but they don't support it.
Yeah.
Not all of them. And so I say, come on, you can't do both.
Yeah,
come on. And so that has been a tricky and discouraging thing for not just me, but for a lot of the nonprofits in town who are on the arts side.
Yeah.
So it's really the big focus has been going. So like I said, corporate giving is down. Individual giving is up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, and there are companies in town who are doing amazing work and, you know, and thank goodness for it. But there are some who've decided to shift. And that's created... when you're used to getting, you know, $20,000 a year from a company, and all of a sudden they're like, we're not going to do that anymore. Yeah, that's huge.
I think because we do STEM for with NuboCo, but I also see a lot of STEAM with theater, you know, with kids, like critical thinking, seeing patterns, being able to follow right. instructions. But you're so right. I think I'm not saying you do not want me on your development team. Like, I would end up begging. Like, it would be embarrassing.
Please.
Yeah, we'd be like, please, please just give us money.
Well, if it works.
Money, please. right. But I think there's such a cool return that they would get from their money. Like the theater, like that is, you know, during COVID, I think a lot of people or big companies forget, like, what did you turn to during COVID? You turned to entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. you know, even though it's some TV shows, but you turned to on Disney Plus when they started putting Hamilton Live
right.
and Lion
Broadway
King.
HD and the opera.
Yeah.
Met opera. Yeah.
And so during those times when everything shut down, like theater was still kind of going. And I think some people forget just how powerful theater can be for a vibrant community. It does bring people in. And I think sometimes what gets people to stay in Cedar Rapids is the opportunity. I've talked to many friends who are in theater who say, well, the reason why I stay here is because there's so many cool opportunities to be on stage and perform shows that I wouldn't get in other cities.
Yeah. And I think part of people go, well, why are theaters struggling now post COVID? Well, a lot of it is, you know, a lot of theaters raised money, including us during COVID. We raised mm-hmm. a lot of money, but then we were sitting on it because we weren't doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute you start doing work, you know, goes out the door. Right. And so that's what happened to a lot of these organizations. And yes, back to your thing about where did they turn to? They turned to the arts, you know, to heal us and to give us encouragement through hard times, which is what the theater's done for years. Mm-hmm. But this gets back to where people find the arts to be a luxury. Mm. They're not a luxury, but people view it that way. And certainly when you look at the cost of tickets to go to shows, it becomes a luxury because a family can't always afford to go. And that could be a whole nother podcast in itself as well. So, it's tricky. So, you know, fundraising is always evolving. People today, the generations today that are you know, younger generations, they're not really interested as much in going to big galas and stuff like that. That's mm-hmm. not really their, you know, it's not like, you know, the baby boomers, they love doing that, the black tie stuff.
Yeah.
Not that we don't like, but, you know, it's not as, they would much rather just say, write you a check mm-hmm. and go to something that was like good music and had served beer, you know? Yeah. It's trying to figure out what is
a balance.
What's the new hip thing that's going to get people in the door. Mm-hmm. And the other trend.
What do you think that is?
I think it's things like that, like not a sit down dinner and with a 3-course meal. And there's something, and I think those are fine, but they'd rather go to like have a concert. There's a concert being performed, and there's 5 different beer vendors there.
Yeah,
and you know it's much more hip and cool, and they get to move around.
Yeah. Right,
you know, and the dress code is not as strict.
Yeah.
So it's even though I like the other, you know, but you know, you got to find that balance. So, you know, and that's the other thing too. It's just constantly evolving and shifting.
But that's when you can use innovative, right? You got to think about that next step above of what the society's norm is, right?
Exactly.
Like what is going to be that next thing that the next audience of, you know, TikTokers are going to want to be able to watch.
Yeah, like a lot of theaters now are doing like this 30 under 30. Like if you're 30 years old, for $30, you and your friends, because they're trying to get that age group in the theater, you know, it's coming up with things like that to like keep building your audience. Yeah. And the other interesting trend that we're all trying to figure out is those in their 30s and 40s, probably more like 35 to 45, they love going to the theater, mm-hmm. which you wouldn't think 20 years ago that was going to be a trend, but they love going to the theater, but they won't give. They think that the ticket is enough. Mm-hmm. So getting them to like say, oh, you like it? Okay, we'll write a check because it's not, otherwise it's not going to be here. Mm-hmm. That's also an interest at hard bridge to gap. And David Jansen once in a meeting, who's the executive director of Bruce Moore, he once said, you know, it's changing the script, meaning you have to educate mm-hmm. your community, and that takes time and resources and constant, you know, hitting the pavement, pounding, you know, mm-hmm. to you know, get people to train them, you know, good habits on what it takes to have this in your community.
I think also like the mindset shift, because I know going as I'm getting older, I think like, oh, that's something someone else does. Like that's older people who like to donate and give money. Like mm-hmm. I'm not, like that's not something
that's
I have
the
power
wealthy.
To. It's for the wealthy. It's for it's for the tax bracket above me. But I think honestly, like for me, sometimes I kind of take a small percentage of my income and like give it back to some way in our community, mm-hmm. because you're so right. Like I can't just keep relying on, well, someone else will do it.
Right.
Because you know, it's not, cause then they're thinking, well, someone else will do it.
Exactly.
So I think also educating those 35 to 40 who are like still maybe the mindset of, well, I think it's like, you know, our parents or our grandparents are the ones who give it's them now. They have to start, you know, passing that.
Well, and the thing is too, that's hard. You know, every organization is this way, especially the theater. They don't want to talk about their struggles, mm-hmm. but you have to be transparent. Say, you know what? We're having trouble paying our bills.
Yeah.
We can't, because if you don't, then everybody thinks you're just fine.
Yeah.
If you're not asking for money, if you're not talking about being transparent about what you are, I think you're floating on cloud nine. You're doing just fine. You know, you got to be transparent and say, we need help. And then people, you'll be surprised. People will step up, but it's hard to be vulnerable and do that. And, And look, yeah, running a nonprofit, it's really hard, mm-hmm. you know, so, and it ebbs and flows all the time, mm-hmm. And choosing, you know, and for us, it's, I find it's a little extra hard because we are not, I'll use the word community theater, where we can do, if we wanted to do a whole season of Disney and I was a community theater, for the most part, I'd be within my mission. Mm-hmm. Or a whole season of Neil Simon. You know, I can shift on a dime easier if I need to because things aren't working. Revival can't necessarily do that. Or these theaters like Utah Shakespeare and Looking Glass, who announced they need like $7 million to stay afloat in like 30 days and are having to postpone their seasons because they do niche work. Mm-hmm. That's important work. But it's not what the, you know, the general population gravitates to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, like I said, we can't just start doing Mamma Mia and, you know, shows like that.
Are you sure?
We can't. okay. Because at the same time, that would also close our doors because that's not what we do.
Yeah.
There's a great story of the Met Opera and New York City Opera. Mm-hmm. For years, the Met Opera did all the big stuff that you knew, the Carmens, the La Bohèmes, all the major operas that most people knew. And New York City Opera did all the stuff the Met wouldn't do, the mm-hmm. more avant-garde stuff, off the beaten path. So they each had their own audience, right? Right. Well, when the New York City Opera started having some struggle issues or whatever the reasons were, they started doing more work like the Met. Well, it closed their doors. Why? Mm-hmm. Because I'm already seeing that at this place.
Yeah.
I already have a subscription to this place. Why would I go see it there?
Right. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So that's what I say. It's really important to stick to your niche. It's hard though mm-hmm. when you're at a time of struggle mm-hmm. and you want to do what everyone else is doing because that's selling.
Yeah.
You want to do the popular thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
stick to your niche.
And would I like to do more niche stuff? You bet. I mean, 1 year I wanted to do like passion. Was it Titanic? And I wanted to do Next to Normal. And it was like, I thought it was great. And, you know, and Cameron's like, okay, we're going to need to handle like antidepressants because everybody coming to the theater is going to be like, okay, I don't know. There's no joy. But see, I would love to do that.
Yeah. Right.
Because it's great art. It's great stuff. But, you know, so yeah, you see, you still have to strike a balance.
I think that would be interesting to do the interview. Like, what made you think of these depressing shows? We're like, well, we need money. And this is just how I feel.
Because
right
I feel like crying in the theater is cathartic.
Oh, yeah.
But that's also a trend, too. I mean, if you look on Broadway, the shows that are doing really well are the shows that
you can cry to.
Honestly, it's not the big flashy Broadway shows. People like want to feel, I mean, people want to go to a show and feel so depressed they go see their therapist on Monday and like that's worth the ticket price.
That's Revival's mission.
That's our new mission. Yeah. That's what they want to do. I mean, you know, it's true. It's it's really, and people are like, oh, after post-COVID, people want to feel good. And yeah, there is that, but it's not really tending to be the trend. Yeah. So,
I love your show. Like, I think sometimes I do. I'm kind of, it's so funny because I love Mamma Mia, okay? I will stand up for Mamma Mia any day of the week.
And I love it too. Yeah. It's just not what we're
No, it's not what you're doing. Yeah. Yeah. And because it's hilarious. Like, it's why people like country music. Like, they don't think about the stupid lyrics to it. It's just simple. The music or the rhyme, like, it just kind of goes and it feels good. But I love your shows going to your shows because I think, oh my gosh, like this is true. Like these are shows that I would never think to watch or go see. Like Ragtime is like my all-time favorite musical now. And I love the music. And yeah, I cry to it all the time. Titanic, should have taken my antidepressant before going to the show.
Wait, you didn't know what happened?
Oh my gosh, like yeah, I guess. I was just thinking, I thought maybe the musical had a spin on
it. Let's face it, even though we know what happens,
we all hope it's gonna change. They're gonna be fine. Yeah. Like, actually, they're going to miss it. Yeah, they're going to miss that iceberg.
Sorry, I'm looking at Rob when I talk about Rob Titanic. I
really didn't like Rob in that show, to be fair. I think he should have. No, I'm joking.
A fun fact, though, when we talk about this, and of course include Rob, even Logan on that end.
We're all
everybody here in this room has been in a play before.
Yeah.
Right? Even myself. You probably didn't think about that. Did
I didn't.
You?
Anthony loves to bring
up
his show.
Were you like a raindrop in middle school or something? I was a raindrop.
Were you?
Yes.
So, so I was only in three. So
three. But you were probably the lead, right?
I mean, so I was a turkey during Thanksgiving. I was on the news. We did like a small play. And then I was SpongeBob in middle school. Oh, not SpongeBob. I was Squidward in the SpongeBob play in middle school. And then I played Jackie Robinson and Jackie and Me before I moved out here to Cedar Rapids. Mm-hmm. And so that one where I was a lead. So I was in choir. Would I say that I sing?
Could you sing a solo?
Yeah.
I probably could.
Is this an audition now, Brian?
Yes.
Yeah.
If it could be in that baritone bass one-ish
five, six,
area.
Seven,
listen,
eight.
Listen, I made a guy audition for me at a restaurant once. So
what?
I had a guy audition for. I said, just sing for me now. Just do it now. Can you sing? Right at a restaurant. I mean, you know.
Was he a waiter or did he just walk by?
No, he was a friend of a friend. And he's like, and I needed someone like him in a show. And I was like, well, sing.
Were you eating your yogurt and be like,
I was not eating yogurt.
Yeah.
But no. So yeah, it's, we were talking about fundraising, but yeah, it's
I love the thought that like you could bring, like everyone has been connected to theater and that would be a good fundraising tactic. And like, who were you like during the birth of Jesus? Cause I know every school did it in the nativity. I was a fox. And okay. We still say my line every single time because that was the only line. And I performed it. So
let's hear it.
Well, I had a Scottish accent, so it was pretty funny.
Let's hear it.
What's all the fuss about? That was my line. What's all the fuss about? I can't believe I said it. My parents are going to love that.
That is good.
But I just love that, like, I think everyone has some kind of connection to theater. Just be like, who were you in Thanksgiving? Be like, well, you know.
Yeah, and I will tell you, like, one of my favorite productions that we do a year, and we don't have one really planned for next year, is our big concert productions, or our version of a concert. Because I love all the community involved in it. Mm. I think it's really exciting.
Yeah, it's great. Well, I think we have talked a lot about theater, and this was a great conversation.
I agree.
It's been so like privileged to like getting to know your process.
Likewise.
So thank you so much for coming. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you guys.
Thanks so much to our guest, Brian Glick, for coming on the show. You can learn more about Revival Theater Company at revivaltheatercompany.com. That's theater spelled with an R-E at the end, by the way. That's the British spelling, by the way. The best way.
And you know the rules. If you love this show, please subscribe and leave a review. You can also visit our blog, nubo.co/blog, to find key takeaways summarized and detailed, of course.
This podcast is produced and distributed by Upload Media Group in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. For more information, go to uploadmediagroup.com.
And so finally, we would love it if you could consider a donation to NuboCo. And I know I always talk about that we would like to have all your monies, but in all seriousness, of course, if you're listening through the podcast with Brian, being able to support a company or nonprofit like NuboCo in the sense of us being able to reach kids in the STEM area, also underprivileged entrepreneurs, and also just different ecosystems within the state of Iowa to be able to help them grow is something that's very important. And it's something that is very important to me, and it's also something that's very important that is also very important for this community. And I know I have the passion for it, and I know that people that listen to this podcast have the passion as well, and you should support NuboCo because we're awesome.
It builds a vibrant community in Cedar Rapids for both you, your neighbors, your children, so your money directly makes a positive impact on the community. So
it does.
Go NuboCo.
Go NuboCo.
To learn more, visit nubo.co/donate.